Lurden High Council.
Thank you, Chair Courtney. This bill revises the deadlines for motions to correct a transcript in cases that are on appeal under certain circumstances.
Anyone sign up? Counsel Liddell?
I don't see anyone signed up on that.
I don't see a sign-up sheet, though. I don't have a sign-up sheet.
I think this is a courts bill, and we should have Jim Nass here on the bill.
Well, I'm...
Are you here on that bill?
Please step... Okay.
That's all right.
It's okay, that's fine.
I'll take care of that.
We take care of everything.
Hey, look at that, we have a full committee even now.
Should I begin?
Sure, yes.
Okay. Vice Chair Courtney and Senator Beyer, my name is Jan Shea. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Judicial Department in favor of House Bill 2338. The purpose of this bill is to clarify three things that are already in our appellate rules. First of all, it would clarify when a transcript is due when an appeal is referred to the Court of Appeals Mediation Program. The second thing it clarifies is when a motion to correct the transcript must be filed in the trial court if the transcript is filed while mediation is pending. And the third thing it would clarify is when a motion to correct the transcript must be filed if more than one transcriptionist is filing the transcript and the filings are made at different times. Two things have occurred since ORS 19370 was enacted. First of all, the Court of Appeals was authorized to create an appellate mediation program. And the second thing was that employees of the trial courts now transcribe testimony, and we often have more than one transcriptionist. So the transcripts are often filed at different times. There was no change to subsection 1, and subsection 2 divides information in subsection 1 into 2 and retains the basic rule that the transcript must be filed within 30 days of the filing of the notice of appeal, and it contains conforming and housekeeping amendments. It also makes the 30-day requirement subject to the exception in new subsection 3, which has to do with the mediation program. Subsection 3 sets up the time for filing the transcript when a case is referred to the Court of Appeals mediation program, and that is 30 days from the expiration of the 120-day abeyance period, and that abeyance period is reflected in our appellate rules, or when the court reactivates the appeal. The court can do that at any time if the parties move to be taken out of the mediation program, so it may occur before the 120 days, but it's whichever occurs first. Subsection 4 was formerly subsection 2, and it's only a housekeeping amendment. Subsection 5 is new, and it implements the policy already contained in ORAP 340, that if there are multiple transcriptionists or reporters, a motion to correct a transcript is not due until the last transcript is filed. The last subsection is new subsection 6, and it sets the time for filing a motion to correct a transcript filed during the 120-day abeyance period. In general, the attorneys will wait to order a transcript, but sometimes for some reason they do that during the period while there is mediation pending. So this allows that to happen and motions to correct to be filed within 15 days from that date of reactivation instead of leaving the parties in the dark on that issue. And the Oregon Judicial Department urges the community to support this bill.
Thank you, Councilor Shea. Any questions? Comments? Thank you very much. Anyone else sign up to testify, Council?
I don't see anyone else on the list.
Anybody else wish to come forward on House Bill 2338?
Thank you, Vice Chair Courtney, members of the committee. My name is Harry Auerbach. I'm actually here to testify on another bill, but I am a mediator for the Court of Appeals Settlement Program, and I think anything you can do to make that program more efficient would be helpful, and I think this is a step that you could take to help us mediate these cases and get them out of the Court of Appeals. So
thank
I'll support the bill. Thank you.
Questions? Comments? Thank you very much. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2338. Open the work session on House Bill 2338. Senator Duncan.
Mr. Chair, I move
House Bill 3.
I move House Bill 2338 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Thank you, Senator Duncan. Senator Duncan has moved House Bill 2338 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Any comments, questions, concerns? Any objections? Done. Close the work session. Open the work
Chair,
session. Chair Appice. Open the work session on Senate Bill 95¢. Senator Metzger, how do you want to proceed?
Well, Mr. Chair, as you recall, Senate Bill 956 we heard a few weeks ago, and the directions that we gave public safety organizations and Nextel Communications, they had asked for some additional time before the work session, which we scheduled today, to report back on the directions from this committee to let us know how they were doing. And so I think, Mr. Chair, maybe the appropriate thing to do would be to invite them up and let us know the progress they have or haven't made in solving this problem.
All right, in deference to the senator from Welch's, all those in the audience, all those human beings in the audience that care about this issue, please come forward. Everybody's welcome. Just because there's four chairs doesn't mean no three. You can add 1,000 chairs. The more the merrier. Anybody else in the audience should be up here, Senator?
Looks like we have what we need.
Please proceed however you wish to do so.
Go ahead.
Senator Courtney, members of the committee, my name is Jeff Johnson, Fire Chief of Tualatin Valley Fire and Rescue, 20665 Southwest Blanton in Aloha, Oregon. I am here today representing the public safety providers in Washington County regarding the topic of the 800 megahertz system and the frequency interference issues that this committee has heard before. I am happy to report and I'd like to express my appreciation to Senator Metzger for bringing this legislation. I can attest that I believe Nextel has been very aggressive in responding to our needs since this legislation was introduced. They have brought their local talents and their national resources to bear on the problem. Since our last appearance before this committee, we have met a number of times and drafted a short-term, mid-term, and long-term strategy. And the long-term strategy could eventually be used as a national rollout strategy, which Chief Randy Brugman of Clackamas County will be responsible for as we move forward in our action plan. Some of our constituents are cautious, and I think they're cautious because they're not sure if Nextel's vigor with which they've pursued and responded to this issue will persist in the absence of legislation. I believe, based on my observation, that with the right parameters, I think they will. They have been good to work with, and I think that they have fulfilled every expectation that we've had for them. So to date, progress is being made not only between the parties, but I think there's honest progress in the field. Communications are being improved and enhanced every day with our technicians working with the 800 megahertz technicians from the public side. And I'm optimistic that given the right environment, that the working relationship will turn into what our long-range plan has in store.
Thank you, Chief.
For the record, I'm Brian DeLashman, representing Nextel. I have with me Steve Leonard for Nextel. Let me just kind of echo what you've just heard. I think there's a sincere effort by Nextel to solve the problem. You have my personal, many of you have known me for a long time. I got involved in this issue with the pure intent of resolving those issues that are attributable to any interference by Nextel. I'm committed to continuing that pressure on my client. and on all the parties that we get this resolved. We think the foundation and the letter that's been signed by all the parties in the Washington County situation lays the groundwork for that. They had a meeting yesterday. They've met several times, as Chief Johnson has indicated, and I think all parties are interested in resolving the issue to its fullest extent possible and also as quickly as possible.
Thank you. Anything else?
I'm Steve Leonard. I'm the work for Nextel. My role is a senior RF manager of RF design and performance for the Pacific Northwest area. And just to echo the statements, we are and have been working very actively to, you know, establish the strategy, move forward, and work on proactive measures that we can take to eliminate, you know, any interference that that may occur. Just to reiterate that we will continue to do so both at a local and a national level. This afternoon, Larry Krever, who was here testifying in April, actually will be sitting down with Motorola, who's our vendor, and discussing this issue at a much higher level with them to continue to make progress.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Susan Schneider with the City of Portland, and I too would like to thank Senator Metzger for bringing this issue to everyone's attention, and also to compliment Nextel on the vigor with which they have pursued this. They've been attentive and motivated and willing to work on solutions. We really appreciate that. They have been working with the City of Portland, who provides the 911 service in Multnomah County, and the issue they've identified as the nature of the interference, and I'm not an engineer, so I can't tell you what this means, but it's called intermodulation. We are going to be testing that theory next week, in the next 2 weeks in East Portland, to see if that, in fact, is the majority or 90% or whatever of the problem. Our engineers are a little bit skeptical. They think that intermodulation is part of the problem, but they think that power output may be the real problem. So hopefully this test will let us determine that. And if it is the latter, then we will need to continue to work to solve this problem. And so we appreciate your attention. Thank you.
Thank you. Any comments, questions?
Mr. Chairman. Mr. Johnson, so as I was reading your kind of your memorandum here of understanding, that you're laying out, and I assume also Mr. DeLashmet, from what Susan just said too, with the City of Portland, kind of a three-tiered approach here. You know, some immediate actions that obviously are underway right now to solve problems, some midterm and some long-term solutions that may even involve some channel swapping or purchasing down the road at some other point. You see that this may actually be something then that we may be able to use as a template for obviously other public safety organizations around the country who are dealing with this issue.
Mr. Chair and Senator Metzger, that's exactly correct, that we believe that this establishes the framework for how we solve our immediate problems and then move toward a more intermediate step, which is kind of unlacing the channels that are close to each other and canceling each other out through this intermodulation phenomenon. And then maybe once you unlace them, push them to either end of the band as a midterm strategy. Then long-term, look to other frequency bands that public safety could be shifted to. Of course, that will require some compensation elements that have yet to be worked out. But I think that that's where the future holds the most promise. Is to first deal with the power retuning, redirecting, second, unlace and move the frequencies apart, and third, try to find a more permanent solution in terms of moving to other bands. And I do believe that with Nextel's attention and with Chief Brugman and other resources in the area, we'll be able to move this to a national level as a template so that maybe we don't have to go out and recreate this whole thing. It'll make it easier on the public safety community. I think it'll also make it easier on Nextel and their local representatives across the country.
Mr. Chair. I would just say, I think, Mr. Chair, I want to commend, first of all, the public safety agencies and Nextel and Mr. DeLashman's leadership on this, because I think it's very clear in the committee meeting that we had 3 weeks ago that this is a very critical problem with some very serious implications, as were brought to us by law enforcement and others who have faced this interference. And it's something that the public needs to know, that, you know, the public safety communication is going to be there, and it's going to be swiftly received. So I think, you know, the issue is very critical. But I think the reaction that we have received from Nextel, as per the direction of this committee, has been outstanding. Certainly the agreement of direction that we have to date from the company and the public safety agencies, I think really can lay out a template. What I think I would suggest, if it's the wish of the committee chair and the committee, is that I would ask that in a couple of weeks I'd like to see the results of your Eastside test from the city of Portland. I'd be very, very curious to have you update the committee on those types of results in terms of identifying the problem. I think from an informational standpoint, the committee would be interested in that. And also on the progress of identifying the long-term strategies and keeping this committee apprised, because I think it is critical that now that we have got this collaboration and solving these problems, that we finish the whole issue there. But I would suggest, since the goal of legislation is to effect change, that sometimes that isn't necessary to move forward at this time, if in fact the change that we desire is going in place. So I would ask, Mr. Chair, that we just hold Senate Bill 956 at this point, not work the bill, recognize the great work that has been done, and ask that they just report back to the committee, you know, later on, to see if in fact we're continuing in the direction that we've been directed.
Okay. Any other comments, committee members? Thank you very much for coming today and testifying. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Anyone else in the audience wish to speak on this issue? Okay, the work session on Senate Bill 956 is closed. Go back to open the which two? Open the public hearing on 2374-72 and work session and public hearing. Would Jeff Johnson come forward, please?
Which one?
3372. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Courtney, members of the committee. My name is Jeff Johnson. I just met my counterpart, Jeff Johnson, for the first time. I've read him quoted in the paper many times in responding to emergencies, so it's always interesting to meet somebody with the same name. I am an attorney and have practiced in Portland for the past 19 years, and I'm currently secretary of the Oregon State Bar Procedure and Practice Committee, and testifying on behalf of that committee in favor of HB 2372. I neglected to provide copies of my testimony. I'm going to be brief. This is a bill. By way of background, I should add that the Procedure and Practice Committee is composed of attorneys throughout the state, and the committee is evenly balanced between attorneys who primarily represent defendants and those who primarily represent plaintiffs in civil litigation. Members of the committee attempt to use their experience and knowledge to enhance the effectiveness of the civil justice system, and not on behalf of particular clients or particular causes. And it is in this context that the committee proposed HB 2372, which we worked on over the interim, which proposes to allow testimony of a witness in a civil jury trial by simultaneous transmission from a location different from the courtroom. Under existing law, such testimony is allowed only in non-jury civil cases and in some other non-jury judicial proceedings under ORS 45.400. What we have here is effectively a trap for litigants, whereby if they have an expert witness that might be physically unable to get to remote locations, such as in Curry County, but the expert might be in another state, might be a person that would be very helpful to resolve the case, they would not be permitted unless they could testify live. And at times there are exigent circumstances where somebody simply cannot get there, and what this bill proposes to do is to allow the advances in technology, video teleconferencing, perhaps any other electronic type of devices that technology may provide us in the future, but it would allow the court to effectively provide for various safeguards to assure that the system is not compromised, that people have the full opportunity to do their cross-examination, but that the but the litigants would then have an opportunity to save some expenses, and the process would then move along expeditiously. And that's what this bill is intended to accomplish. The rest of my remarks are laid out in the testimony that I provided. I don't know if there are any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Questions for Council Johnson regarding this piece of legislation, allowing the person to testify not on site, as I say, civil proceedings? Thank you very much. We're in work session.
We're down to three members.
All right, let's just go quickly to House Bill, close the public hearing work session on 2372 and go to House Bill 2374. Open that public hearing work session. We're again going to hear from Mr. Jeff Johnson. See if the witness is there.
Thank you again. This is another, for the record, Jeff Johnson, and a trial practitioner for in Portland for the last 19 years, and again testifying on behalf of the Procedure and Practice Committee for the Oregon State Bar. This was a piece of legislation that we authored in response to the Supreme Court, the Judiciary Department, asking us to try to resolve some conflicts in case law pertaining to what the court is to do when you have multiple prevailing parties. The case is, and I just to put this into very simple terms, we have frequently, through the use of consolidation of cases, if you have a claim brought by a party, say, for example, a breach of contract claim, where the contract provides for a right to attorney fees, the defendant then decides they're going to counterclaim, and they're going to, they theoretically would say, well, you may have a breach of contract claim, but on the other hand, you have, you are violating the Unlawful Trade Practices Act, which does provide by statute a right to attorney fees. And the case, because there are common facts, is tried in the same courtroom at the same time. Is theoretically possible and does in fact happen where one party prevails on the contract claim and then this has the right to attorney fees because it was privately bargained for. The defendant also prevails on the Unlawful Trade Practices Act and has a right to attorney fees because you, the legislature, provided for that right. So the trial court then is left to decide who is the quote-unquote prevailing party for purposes of attorney fees. And the court, what we found is that the courts have had great difficulty in determining whether or not there is a possible to have more than one prevailing party in a case. This problem is created only because of the rule of joinder and consolidation, which was designed to allow the joinder of claims to consolidate cases to expedite the judicial process. The downside, of course, has been that if you have a statutorily granted right to attorney fees and you win, you can still lose your right to attorney fees, thus defeating the statutory intent to allow a litigant to be able to recover if they want to prosecute that statutory claim. What this, what we attempted to do in the committee is to try to find a win-win, which we think we have found, and that is that if you prevail on your claim, then you will get your right to attorney fees, and it resolves that conflict in the case law. And you still have to provide supporting documentation. You still have it is. I want to emphasize one point. It does not create a new right to attorney fees. It does not amend any or affect or take away a right to attorney fees. Attorney fees are allowed under case law and under statutes in only two ways. So either it's bargained for by private parties in a contract or it's allowed for by statute. And nothing in this legislation will change that. It just is a mechanism by which the court is now able to determine who is a prevailing party and does allow for multiple prevailing party attorney fees. Any questions?
Any questions for counsel? Thank you, Mr. Johnson.
Thank you
very much for coming today and testifying.
Thank you.
Senator Duncan?
Are we in work session?
We are.
Okay. Mr. President, Mr. Chair, I move that House Bill 2374 be sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Duncan has moved House Bill 2374 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any questions, any comments, discussion, any objections? It's done.
Do you want to go back to the other one?
I do. I'd like to go back to House Bill 2372.
Chair,
work session on that.
I move House Bill 2372A be sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. The Senator from all of Milwaukee has moved House Bill 2372 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Questions, comments, any objections? It's done. Senator Duncan can put him on that first statement.
Senator Courtney's going to carry 2374.
I guess I'll catch Congress. The other one he can, because it's telecommunications, and even though he shut his committee down and we don't need any more, he can.
Senator Duncan's going to carry 2372.
Yeah, you understand that? That's
yeah.
The one on telecommunications.
Right.
Can, that might interest you in terms of the technology and things.
Yeah, that's my thing.
Huh?
That's my thing.
Yeah, that's your thing. Okay, let's go on here. I know that. Which one went to? Okay, open the public hearing and work session on 2362, please. May I speak? 61. 2361. Thank you, Mayor. Keith Garza. It's coming before us on 2361. Thank you. That's what helps us to appreciate it. Yeah, that's good.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Keith Garza. I am the senior staff attorney of the Oregon Supreme Court. I also serve as a member at large on the appellate practice section of the Oregon State Bar's Executive Committee. I'm here this afternoon only in my capacity as a member of the Executive Committee and not on behalf of the court. 2361 is a response to an Oregon Supreme Court decision in 1999 called Rauda versus Oregon Roses. I think the decision with respect to its legal holding was unremarkable. It reaffirmed close to a century's worth of case law to the effect that a stipulated judgment, that is one that is entered into with the consent of both parties, is not appealable. House Bill 2361 would change that legislative policy. The Court of Appeals, I am told, receives 2 to 4 cases a year in which parties to stipulated judgments seek to reserve a right to appellate review, only to have those appeals dismissed for lack of jurisdiction. And House Bill 2361 would remedy that and let appeals in those instances proceed to disposition on the merits. The -1 amendments to 2361 seek to clarify that while it will permit stipulated judgments to be reviewed on appeal so long as there is an express provision in the judgment reserving a right to appellate review, that that does not mean that a non-justiciable appeal may be maintained in the appellate courts for purposes of obtaining an advisory opinion. And I'd be happy to answer any questions that the members might have.
Mr. Chair.
Questions for Council Garza. Senator Duncan.
Collusive appeal. Can you explain that?
Sure. For example, assume that the two parties to a piece of litigation have decided that it is in their best interest to simply settle the matter. It presents an interesting legal question, but they want to eliminate any risk, and yet at the same time have a legal determination to the underlying dispute. So if, for example, the parties were to settle, money were to change hands, there were to be no practical relief that the court could provide to those parties. The courts have held that that is not a justiciable case. It calls on the court to issue an advisory opinion, and it's not willing to do so under those circumstances. So this would mean this bill would be limited to situations in which the parties have concluded that there are some things that they agree about, some things that they disagree about, and they want to be able to maintain an appeal over to that to which they disagree. If they agree as to everything, then there's no longer any reason for the courts to be involved.
Okay. Other questions, counsel? Counsel, I'm curious, why weren't the -1 amendments added in on the House side?
I believe that the Dash 1 amendments came about when the executive committee met to consider the wording on the bill for a second time. So I think it simply was a matter of timing. I was at the meeting where this wording was adopted by the executive committee, and I think it was simply as a matter of bad timing.
Thank you, counsel. Further questions, comments?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Byron.
Thank you. The Supreme Court overturned the lower court decision in the Oregon Roses case, correct?
I believe, well, I think it simply dismissed the appeal. I'll take a look at the wording of the decision. I believe that the court of the circuit court had entered the stipulated judgment. That stipulated judgment was appealed by the defendant to the Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals ruled on the appeal, and it was only when the case was on review in the Supreme Court that the jurisdictional question was addressed.
Okay, well, Mr. Chair, at the Oregon Roses lost in the first round, and hence we had the bill in 1997 dealing with the Oregon Roses case. In 1999, the bill was vetoed by the governor. In 1999, the bill came forward on dealing with this issue, and it was, and I don't remember, anyway, the Oregon Roses case was then overturned, but a technicality, and I'm just trying to figure out, not being an attorney, what we're doing here.
Mr. Chair?
I'm asking.
That's a good point. You know, I was thinking a similar line. Could you, would the witness give us a layman's example, if this were into effect, an example of what this would do? You know, could you create a case for us, a minor one, that this would change?
Sure. Mr. Chairman, Senators Metzger and Beyer, maybe I could just use the facts in Rauta itself.
Okay.
In that case, the plaintiffs were agricultural workers who were terminated by their employer, I believe, for having discussed the terms of their compensation with the employer's agent. The plaintiffs filed two claims in respect of those discharges, that there was a breach of contract and that the termination was unlawful as a matter of law. The defendant moved to dismiss the complaint in its entirety, get rid of both claims. And the trial court dismissed the breach of contract claim, said, plaintiffs, you have no claim there, but refused to dismiss the wrongful termination case. Now, at that point, the parties stipulated to an entry of a judgment. I guess the plaintiffs were happy that their wrongful termination claim survived. The defendants were not. But at the same time, the parties didn't see the need to go forward and litigate issues of fact. And indeed, even issues with respect to damages, if it were to be determined later that the plaintiffs actually had stated a cause of action for unlawful termination. And so they entered into a stipulated judgment in which they acknowledged that the contract claim had been dismissed, the unlawful termination claim had not, and that the defendant has offered to stipulate that the amount of damages would be $30,000, reserving nevertheless its right to appeal the denial of the motion to dismiss the unlawful termination claim. So it was a situation in which, of all of the issues that had been brought initially, there was only the legal question about whether, as a matter of law, there was an unlawful termination cause of action under these types of circumstances. And simply because of the way the case proceeded to judgment, that is, with both parties agreeing that judgment should be entered, again, under long-standing precedent, that document, the stipulated judgment, was not an appealable instrument because I think it goes back historically to the idea that usually on appeal, the challenge is that the trial court did something incorrect with respect to the judgment. And if the parties agree to have that judgment entered, it means, it did, and still I guess does today, that there is no error of the trial court. It is an error, if anything, of the parties. And also kind of goes back to an idea about merger into the final judgment of any errors that might have been committed by the trial court before judgment is entered. And these are all matters of statute, and it is within the purview of the legislature to state when and under what circumstances appellate jurisdiction will lie.
How would this change, though, under this statute?
Under House Bill 2361, the RAUDA stipulated judgment would have been an appealable instrument.
Even so, they agreed, but someone, either side could at a later date appeal that under,
sure,
under this new law.
Sure, and I think to be accurate, under 2361, the judgment would have to contain an express reservation of a right to appeal. If it simply said, you know, stipulated judgment and that was the end of it, 2361 would not convert that into an appealable instrument. You would have to specifically contemplate an appeal. So that would take it away from the usual case in which the parties to litigation settle, enter a stipulated judgment of dismissal, and that's the end of it. If one of them were to get have second thoughts, you know, 15 days or so after that, they're not going to be, I don't believe, under this wording, permitted to seek an appeal from that. However, if they want simply to terminate the litigation quickly and economically and not fight about things over which they don't disagree, this would permit that to happen. I hope that was responsive to your questions.
Further questions, comments? Thank you for your testimony here today.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Senator Metzger, Senator Navarro, where are you in this piece of legislation? Okay, close the work session on and public hearing on House Bill 2361, and we're going to House Bill 2387, and open the work public hearing work session. Harry Albar, please. The City of Portland, Multnomah County, I guess. 2387.
Vice Chairman Courtney, members of the committee, my name is Harry Auerbach. I am a senior deputy city attorney for the City of Portland. I'm here. I presented written testimony on the House side, and I hope that's part of your record. I didn't duplicate it here today, but I will tell you that we have basically two concerns about the bill, one of which, if you deal with one of it, it'll make the other one moot as far as we're concerned, but it'll still be an issue the committee might want to think about. Our two concerns are this. Under the present law, if you have people who own property as tenants in common with undivided interests, and they can't get along, and they can't figure out how to use the property, and they have conflicts that require judicial intervention, the court can do a couple of things. It can either partition the land so that each party then has a separate piece of property that he holds by himself, or the court can essentially force the sale of the interest to the person who is seeking the partition to the other party. What the bill would do is to change that law so that the court could force the sale of any of the tenants of in common, whether or not that tenant was seeking the partition. So if you have a party who is happy with the way things are going and somebody else decides they're unhappy, that other party could force the sale of a person who has absolutely no interest in selling his property or changing his relationship. Our concern about that is twofold. First of all, the bill doesn't contain any direction to the courts as to how they are to decide which party's interest should be sold. As the law is now, it's fairly straightforward. If you ask for a partition and there's no other way to resolve the issue, your interest is the one that's going to get sold, so you really better have a problem before you go to court and start mucking around with people's property interests. This bill would change that so any party's interest could be sold, but it wouldn't tell the courts how they're to decide between the person seeking a partition and the person who's not as to whose party interest should be sold. And if the bill goes forward, it might be advisable to include some standards or some direction. I was unable to suggest any to you because I honestly don't know what the purpose of the bill is. So I'm unable to enlighten you there, but it is an issue that will have to be worked out. The other interest that that I am going to ask the committee to do something about is the notion that there could be a forced sale of government property. Under the current state of the law, in many, as it's expressed in many different places, you can't force the sale of government property, and there's very good reasons for that. The government, when it owns property, does so essentially in trust for the people, and it is, in our opinion, poor public policy to allow the non-consensual sale of government property. And so I have asked, and you should have the Dash 2 amendments, which we have suggested, which would add a sentence, or as it's drafted, a subsection 2, that would say a court may not order the discharge of an interest of a public body in real property without the consent of the governing body of the public body. This essentially mirrors the language of the way of necessity statute, which contains a similar provision. If you want a way of necessity over publicly held property, you can't get one unless the governing body of the public body consents. And our position would be that it would be appropriate to have a similar limitation in the forced partition bill. If the committee has questions, I'd be happy to answer them. Otherwise, that's it.
Mr. Chair?
Minister.
Can you give me an example of when a public body would either own property in joint with a private citizen, or are you thinking of two public bodies owning the same property?
I can give you an example when we do have two public bodies owning property, undivided interest in property in common, and I can tell you an example where we almost did with a private party, and potentially could. When Metro took to the voters its green spaces bond measure, open spaces bond measure, the measure had two components. There was the regional component and a local component. And with the local component, Metro made money available to local governments for purchasing property. Some of the purchases that have been done under that program have been done structured so that there are undivided interests between Metro and the local government. So the city of Portland owns a number of properties in which we are tenants in common with Metro in varying percentages based upon our degrees of contribution toward the property. So there are examples of where we do in fact own properties, undivided tenants in common. I had another situation that I was working on for the city of Portland in which we were attempting to acquire property that was held by a number of parties, some of whom were more amenable to working with us than others. So at one point, we considered the possibility of buying their undivided interests. And so if we had gone ahead with that strategy, although we haven't, because it appears we'll be able to work it out otherwise, if we had gone ahead with that strategy, that would have been a situation in which we would have owned property as tenants in common with private parties.
Okay. Further questions? Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you very much.
Dash 2 amendments. Senator Duncan, you don't move the Dash 2 amendments.
Mr. Chair, I move Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2387.
Any objections?
Mr. Chair, yes.
I'm not sure that I agree that with the Dash 2 amendments at this, and I just, you know, you've got four votes, so I can always vote no.
Okay.
Does the courts to divide interest of two private owners. You know, I don't agree with treating public bodies differently just because they're public bodies and they can't get along. Why they should be subject to different rules than private people.
Okay. For the comments, for the record, any objections to this motion? With exception that Senator Beyer is going to object. Is there any objections? Let me just check one thing. Let it go. I'm a little nervous because I don't know what the sponsor of the bill is and what's going on. So we did amend it, and Let's see where we are. I think I'm just going to hold it over another. Right, but I want to go back. Senator Metzger, let me just briefly go into recess. We got to be able, somebody's not here to talk on yet. We got to. Council, even though the lead witness is not here, can you comment at all on what's the bill before us? Get that on the record.
It clarifies that in cases where an initial administrative decision, and there he is made without a hearing on matters involving discretionary land use permit decisions, the appeal from that decision constitutes the initial evidentiary hearing open to any party withstanding. And perhaps Mr. Crane could tell us why this bill is needed.
Yes, as we voted, the High Council spoke, Chris Crane entered the room, the lead and only witness at this time. So, Mr. Crane, could you tell us what's going on here?
Senator Courtney, members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity to testify on behalf of House Bills 2371. I am Chris Crane. I'm an attorney with the law firm of Miller Nash in Portland. Where I practiced land use and real estate. Before that, I was with Legislative Council for 5 years, from 1995 to 2000. There's a provision in the law, both for cities and counties, that says that the first hearing on review of a director's, or the planning director's decision shall be de novo, the first public hearing. Most of us in the land use community, certainly when we drafted the bill, thought that de novo meant all the issues are out on the table, you know, anybody can come testify on anything. What has happened is that a few local governments have put a provision in their code that says when you appeal a planning director's decision, keep in mind the planning director's decision is not made with any public input generally, certainly not a public hearing. If you appeal a planning director's decision, you can specify the issues you are appealing, and then the public hearing is limited to those issues. So by the time you get to the first public hearing on a land use application, you're already limited to whatever issues the person appealing it wants to limit the public hearing to. And that was contrary to what most of us thought de novo meant. We thought de novo meant everything's wide open, you can address. So we drafted this bill to clarify that the first public hearing on a land use application, even on appeal from a director's decision, has to be an open public hearing and all issues are open for discussion. Thereafter, the local government can, you know, limit the hearing, say it has to be on the record, you have to specify what issues you're appealing. It could, in other words, appeal from that first public hearing can be more limited, but the first public hearing should be de novo in the sense that it's open for discussion on every and all issues anybody wants to bring up. That's the purpose of the bill. We believe it does that, and with that, you should have my testimony in front of you. I'd be glad to answer any questions.
We also have testimony from 1,000 Friends, a written statement from Michael Kohlmeyer. It's in your file as well. It should be. I hope it is. It's in my file anyway. And they indicate they support this bill as it is before us. Questions for Mr. Crane. Council Crane, please, who did serve in legislative council, drafted maybe some of your bills. Maybe you didn't draft some of your bills. Maybe you drafted some of your amendments. Maybe you don't even never heard of them before, but he's here. Drove all the way down from Portland to do this, I have a feeling. Thank you, Mr. Crane. I'm sorry we had to catch you out of breath. I think you were just need to catch your breath, so I hope we didn't offend you.
The uncanny timing that I honed over my years here, I could sense my presence was required, so I showed up when I was needed. Thank you very much.
No, Mr. Crane, it's not your timing. It's the chair's ability to conduct hearings efficiently.
Absolutely.
I do not really appreciate the fact that you're trying to take credit and something you have to do with.
I stand corrected.
For that, would you please leave the witness stand? All right. I think this is a nice piece of legislation, having just gone through a whole appeal process. I'm not going to get into what happened. I actually like this legislation because I think all this talk about DeNovo and everything.
Are you in which session?
We're in the whole, yeah, we are.
Mr. Chair, go ahead. Oh, I just was going to move
that
House Bill 2371 be sent before the due pass recommendation. Wait, no amendments.
There aren't any amendments. This is just clean and pure.
No.
Well, I know, but, you know, you can vote no and then vote no on the floor for the same reason. You can vote explanation or maybe during the... You move to the just turn down. Okay, I'm sorry. I was the Senator Barr had a remark to make about certain things in our file.
I wish you'd listen to me because I am an important member of this committee.
Senator Vern Duncan has moved House Bill 2371 to the Senate Bill 4 to do pass recommendation. Are there any objections?
Well, just for the record, I'm not objecting, but I do wish that the letter from 1,000 friends wasn't in the file. It would make me a lot more comfortable voting yes if it wasn't there.
Thank you. There's no objection. Hearing that, we'll pass. Let the record reflect. Senator Barr is joining with the 1,000 Friends of Oregon to support House Bill 2382, House Bill 2371.
And is he carrying the bill as well?
And would you? Oh, you're not carrying the bill.
I'll carry it.
Senator Messer would like to carry the bill and join with the 1,000 Friends supporting House Bill 2371, and he will note in the record and inform that you are with him. I guess we're done because the other two bills, there's things going on. I don't want to force the vote, and it won't work, and I don't want to do it anyway. So I think we're done, aren't we, Council? Pretty much done?
I think we're done.
Okay. Anything else people want to put on the record before we go and shut this thing down? I think we even...
Thank you again, Mr. Chair, for running a very efficient committee and getting us out here early. This is the second time you've done. I appreciate it.